The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
It's been over 9 years since the UK voted to leave the EU, and yet both sides are still working on various trade agreements. Prime Minister Keir Starmer is in the middle of negotiating an agricultural deal, and while some see it as the UK edging closer to the EU, politicians are worried about what a Farage premiership would do to the already fraught relations between the two blocs. So would any new deal require to be Farage-proofed in advance of any such political development? Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London. Tim, good morning.
Good morning.
So, is it intended to put in a Farage clause?
Well, this is how it's been billed by some anonymous sources in Brussels. I think, understandably, they are worried that if they come to some agreement with the Starmer government, if there is an election in 28-29 that brings a Farage government to power, that the UK may want to withdraw from that agreement. And as you know, is the case in many commercial contracts, they want to insert some kind of penalty clause, which would hopefully prevent that happening, or at least make a Farage government think twice about it.
Now, have we had such penalty clauses before, and have they been implemented? Has money changed hands?
We haven't actually had them invoked as yet. Obviously, you know, there are a few agreements between the EU and the UK, but so far the UK government hasn't pulled out of anything, and nor has the EU. But there's no doubt that in most agreements, as in the commercial world, there will always be some kind of termination clause. Because obviously, in any agreement, there is a degree of spending up front. And certainly with regard to this SPS deal that is about to be negotiated, if it were to come into place, there would be a lot of infrastructure spending, there would have to be a lot of people recruited, and it's quite understandable in some ways that the EU wants to make sure that if it does spend money up front, that it will get it back if a Farage government were to, as it were, renege on the deal.
Now, the EU, in pricing Brexit, as it were, put a 5.4 billion adjustment reserve in place in 2020 to deal with disruption. For example, Ireland was allocated 920 million, Netherlands more than 800 million, and that was to put customs officers in place, veterinary officers, and so on and so forth. So these are real costs that would be incurred if the infrastructure of a deal negotiated by Starmer was suddenly to be dismantled by Farage.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. But of course, you know, we're talking here about the kind of the detail of the agreement. We've yet actually to begin negotiations on what the agreement would be. I think the problem for the UK is that it's fairly obvious that in some ways the EU needs this agreement less than we as the UK do. At the moment, we are suffering in terms of our agri-food exports, our food and drink exports. And it's reckoned that a deal, at least as far as the UK is concerned, would improve those exports by around kind of 20%. So in some ways, to use President Trump's terms, you know, the EU holds the cards. And it's understandable, if you like, that it will impose conditions.
So when Keir Starmer talks about a reset of relations between the UK and the EU, what exactly does he mean? I mean, this is a single deal on agricultural produce, but are we talking about getting closer to the single market or the customs union or both?
Well, I think increasingly what we're hearing out of Downing Street is the idea of dynamic alignment. So the idea that when the EU changes its rules on anything, the UK automatically changes its rules, which actually means a much swifter process. I think a lot of people within the Labour cabinet are now looking at the failure, in some senses, of the government to get growth going in this country and looking towards a kind of closer alignment with Europe in order to do that. Now, there is some talk of, you know, getting to some kind of customs union. It's not the customs union. It would have to be a customs union, much in the way as Turkey has one or the Swiss has one. But there are people within government and, of course, lots of external commentators who think actually a customs union isn't going to cut it, that in fact, in the end, the advantage is lie with somehow joining or at least, as I say, dynamically aligning with the single market. The single market really is the thing that reduces friction and would, you know, bring a great deal of benefit to the UK economy, which is struggling.
The critics, of course, will say this is reversing Brexit by stealth.
Yes, of course. And Nigel Farage has already said, you know, if the EU were to impose some kind of penalty, he wouldn't pay it. He would withdraw from the agreement. And in some ways, you could argue that what Brussels has done by framing it, this idea as a kind of Farage clause, is all grist to his mill. He can present himself as, you know, the defender of British interests, the defender of British sovereignty. He can suggest that somehow the Labour government is doing a kind of dodgy deal behind closed doors with Brussels, which he won't honour. He has got a point when he says, because of the way that the UK political system works, that no parliament can bind its successor. But having said that, obviously, if the UK signs some kind of trade agreement with anybody, the EU or anybody else, generally speaking, in international law, those agreements have to be honoured or you have to pay.
Now, the problem with the UK economy, maybe these problems were coming. I mean, the UK is not what it once was as an imperial global power. But at the same time, there seemed to be a step change after Brexit. Brexit effectively destroyed parts of the UK economy. Nobody's saying that, though. Even the Labour Party are afraid to say, listen, Brexit was wrong. We opposed it at the time. Then we went along with it. And then we promised not to reverse it. But really, it's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, you have had in recent weeks, actually, some ministers, and it's been folded into, you know, the debate over whether some ministers want to replace Keir Starmer, unfortunately. But some ministers are now saying, you know, in terms that actually, you know, Brexit has harmed the UK economy, and that we need to do something, particularly getting closer to the single market, in order to do something about that. So there is, you know, a degree of honesty, if you like, a degree of discontent trickling out. But I think you're quite right to say that at the moment, the UK government seems to be very loath to actually acknowledge quite how bad the hit has been. And certainly, they've gone nowhere near as far as most economists, for example, in suggesting that it's had a huge impact on our GDP.
Now, the problem also, I suppose, is that principal opposition party at the moment being the Conservative Party. I mean, they were the architects of Brexit. David Cameron's catastrophic mistake to give in to Farage and his ilk in having a referendum at a time. And even the opportunity to pause the referendum when Joe Cox was murdered in the name, I suppose, of Brexit. When that happened, he didn't do it. He kept going and lost.
Yes, I mean, I think it's going to take time for the Conservatives. You've talked about Labour being loath to actually acknowledge some of the problems. I think it's going to take time for the Conservatives, if they ever do, to admit that Brexit was in some ways a mistake and certainly has had negative consequences for the economy. The Conservatives, I'm afraid, are still clinging to the idea that somehow if Brexit had been done properly, if, you know, the benefits had been celebrated, if this Labour government wasn't trying to get closer to Brussels, but instead of sort of striking out on its own and doing more trade deals, then everything would be hunky-dory. I think it obviously the emotional cost for Conservatives to admit that they were wrong is so high. I can't see that happening for decades, to be honest.
I suppose when you look at the campaigns around Brexit, it was fundamentally, I think, a racist campaign. I mean, it was about keeping Johnny Foreigner, particularly Johnny Foreigner of colour, out of Britain. It didn't work.
No. And I mean, one of the ironies, of course, of Brexit is that, in fact, net migration increased massively as people from the EU went home. And in order to replace them, we brought in far more people from non-EU countries. Actually, immigration is beginning to go down now, partly because of restrictions that the Conservative government under Rishi Sunak imposed, and partly because those have been continued by the Labour government. But you're certainly right to say that as far as most voters were concerned, or at least many Leave voters were concerned, Brexit was about reducing immigration, and that's precisely what they have not got. And in some ways, it's quite remarkable that Nigel Farage and indeed the Conservatives has not been held to account on that score. In fact, until, you know, this incident that we're talking about right now came up, Nigel Farage hasn't talked very much about Brexit in recent months and years. He's moved on to talk about migration. And as you say, migration was always the trump card in some ways.
So where are we now in terms of the generality of the UK economy. I mean, I'm not there very often, so I don't see it. But some people report on, you know, declining public services. We do hear regularly on our news bulletins, which we get from the BBC and ITV, about waiting lists to even to see your GP, people on trolleys and so on and so forth. So there has been a decline. Is that decline one that is noticed by everyone and shared by everybody?
Yeah, and I think actually that did have a lot to do with the really catastrophic defeat that the Conservative Party faced in 2024. Actually, crumbling public services are very obvious, are very tangible. I think Labour is doing its best to try and reverse some of the waiting times in the NHS, and I think gradually they will be able to turn those around. That is the historic pattern, that Labour spends more on the National Health Service and things get a little bit better. But, you know, like many other countries, we're beginning to see, you know, a decline in the kind of public realm. So some of the infrastructure in terms of transport, I think, is really struggling. Potholes are a real problem that everybody complains about. Our high streets obviously are emptying out as more people do their shopping online, and we haven't really, you know, worked out what to do, in fact, with the kind of overallocation of space to retail that, you know, was fine in the 1970s and 1980s, but now is beginning to look really, really problematic. So, yes, we have got a lot of problems. And, you know, our main problem, and the government's main problem in some ways, is the fact that our growth rate is so anemic and our productivity is so poor, which means that, you know, revenues for government, tax revenues have gone down, and therefore they haven't really got as much money as they would like to try and improve some of those things that we've just talked about.
Now, the final question, Tim, is about the huge numbers of people who are not in work, even though it appears there's lots of work available. And Labour has tried to do something about it. And, you know, there was talk of limiting social welfare payments to families of a certain size, all of those kind of measures. But the workless, the underemployed or unemployed, how is that problem to be addressed? Because, as I say, it appears there's lots of work to be done.
Yeah, I mean, the main problem is younger people, actually, at the moment, the so-called NEET, so not in employment or education, so people aged between 18 and 24. There are some suggestions that perhaps it's to do with overdiagnosis of, you know, mental health issues, and some people are on, as it were, sick payments rather than actually going out and finding work. It's very, very difficult to diagnose it exactly what is the problem. But certainly, as far as young people are concerned, the government is trying to do something. It's trying to guarantee work or apprenticeships for, you know, I think it's 50,000 people. But when you think about the kind of million or so that are unemployed or out of education, that's not really going to touch the sides, to be honest.
Finally, one of my listeners has offered this. A few ironic facts about Farage. His first wife was Irish. His second wife was German. His current girlfriend is French. And he's admitted that all his kids have EU passports. So there.
Hypocrite. Well, I'll leave that to the listeners.
Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London. Thank you very much, Tim, for joining us on the programme.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.